This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Ahead this hour, we'll find out what President Obama's proposal to end the NSA's bulk phone data collection could mean for national security.
But first, it's a look at our relationship with death, why we fear it on the one hand and find ourselves fascinated on the other.
Our next guest went on a journey to learn about Americans' evolving customs when it comes to death, burial, and memorials. She writes about it in her new book, American Afterlife, Encounters in the Customs of Mourning.
Kate Sweeney is a reporter and producer at WABE in Atlanta, and she joins us from her studio there. Kate, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, what inspired you to set off and explore the topic of death in the first place?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm not a really gloomy person. And so, you know, I wasn't hanging out in a lot of cemeteries wearing black and listening to the Smiths, although I do like visiting cemeteries a great deal. Really, I think what started me out is I like sort of realms of little known facts. And if there's any realm of little known facts that is sort of ripe for the picking in the United States of America right now, it is funeral present and the funeral world past. You know, sort of before I knew what was happening, I sort of became a miniature expert in things like the history of embalming fluid and everything that goes into making a funeral what it is. And that was so much fun and really, really fascinating. And then sort of, I guess the other part to that was as I kept going and got stories of folks who found themselves involved with death and memorialization to write the book, I found myself asking myself, okay, why are you really writing this? And I think that one answer was there I was in my late 20s, early 30s, someone who'd never really experienced catastrophic loss. And since it's one of those things for which there is no cut and dry answer for how do you handle this, the next best thing I think is we get stories from each other. Okay, well, what did you do? What did you do? And I think on some level, that is another reason that I wrote the book.
Looking at the history, the story you tell about how things have changed, it seems like there's a theme that we look back and things maybe look kind of creepy back then, but death was a lot closer to our daily lives, and now it's way more separate and isolated from our daily lives.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look back in, say, the 1800s, which we think of as the heyday of sort of death culture in the United States, and it really was. I mean, this is the time when the cemetery, as we know it, was invented. This is the time when the deathbed scene was invented. But people saw a lot more death in their everyday lives back then, certainly. And then around the turn of the century, something interesting happened is death really started to move out of the house. And dying did as well. People, rather than dying at home, began to die in hospitals. There was a room in the house called the parlor. This was the room where you might court your sweetheart, where you might get married, and then your funeral might take place. And so as the first standalone funeral businesses started to come to be, they called themselves funeral parlors, named after that room. And then, you know, a few years later, you know, as folks were looking at the parlor, the house, when people were becoming a little bit more removed from the processes of death and dying, there was actually a concentrated move. Let's change the name of this room from the parlor to the living room. And I remember hearing about that, and it just kind of blew my mind. I was like, wow. So this really was an intentional move, you know, away from death sort of being in our everyday lives.
Right. And it seems to correspond with us becoming less and less comfortable with death. And then if I look at another example that you write about, you know, people used to wear hair jewelry of their loved ones who'd passed on, and they were fine with that.
Right. And that even, it even still makes me uncomfortable, even as I understand it more than I did when I started the book. There was a moment in the book where I find myself standing in the Museum of Funeral Customs in Springfield, Illinois, and I'm in this room kind of surrounded by pieces of hair jewelry, and I'm kind of looking at them and figuring out, oh, it's a watch fob. Where's the hair? And then I realized, oh my goodness, the entire thing is made from human hair. Because nowadays, you know, we might craft or, you know, have ordered a piece of jewelry with, you know, someone's ashes in them. But there's something a little more visceral about having a necklace or a watch fob or a tiara or a wreath over your fireplace made of, you know, someone's hair. Because you look at ashes, you think, ashes. You look at hair, you think of the person upon whose head that hair was. And yeah, certainly we've definitely become less comfortable.
You mentioned the Museum of Funeral Customs. You spend a lot of time there working on the book. It looks like it is passed on, unfortunately, before I got to visit it in Illinois. But what did you learn from there? What kind of things were on display?
Well, I mean, this was really, so many things in the Museum of Funeral Customs. The curator there told me it takes most people about 45 minutes to walk through the display, and it took me more than 2 hours because it was so fascinating. So, one thing was just sort of this world of all of this Victorian stuff. This was really the era of when somebody died, you knew what to do because there were set rules for death and memorialization, and it was a normal part of life. And so the museum was filled with one entire section of memorial clothing, just black things that people wore. There was a material called funeral crepe that was scratchy and uncomfortable, and it was uncomfortable and ugly on purpose. And funeral crepe was made, strangely enough, of silk, the most beautiful of fabrics, made intentionally into the most ugly and uncomfortable of fabrics on purpose because it was for mourning.
But it seemed like the Victorians really knew their way around death. They do, you know, we talked about being comfortable. They seemed like they were incredibly comfortable and had this very rich culture around death. What could we learn from the Victorians?
I think if we could learn anything from the Victorians, it might be to appreciate the idea of the good death a little more. And the good death was a concept that was extremely important to folks in the 1800s. And this was the idea of dying, ideally, in their time, at home, surrounded by loved ones, and then also ideally, because this was influenced by evangelical Christianity, being saved. But sort of this idea of you know, dying at home in relative comfort and surrounded by our loved ones, that's something we just don't see anymore today. And I think that's a reason that we might be a little bit alienated from death. Certainly, you know, I don't envy the Victorians everything. I don't envy them. There was one rule for funeral etiquette and mourning etiquette that, you know, if you were the second wife of a husband and his first wife's parents died, there were particular mourning rules that you had to follow. You were then in mourning, you know, whether or not you wanted to be. And I don't envy this idea of maybe having 12 children and losing 9 of them. I don't envy that death rate. But you know, for being surrounded by death, as people tended to be, and, you know, experiencing things like the Civil War, it was a part of everyday life. It was an expected part of life. A lot of people that I talked to for this book who had experienced catastrophic loss in the here and now sort of kept telling me the same thing, that they didn't feel just sad and in mourning and in grief when they lost loved ones. They felt sort of bewildered, you know, kind of set off into the wilderness, like they weren't a part of regular society anymore. And people didn't really know what to do with them because, I mean, nowadays, you know, you go to a funeral and then you're expected to return to work and sort of behave in a normal manner. And you're not really sure how to behave and people aren't sure how to behave toward you. So it might be a matter of incorporating death, which is a normal part of life, back into sort of everyday life.
And you introduced us to a person who tried for a while to help people do that, a tattoo artist who specialized in memorial tattoos.
Yes, Sarah Peacock. That was amazing because I was having these conversations with her about really, she was telling me serious stories about people in grief and in mourning. And instead of sort of talking in these quiet, hushed tones, we were shouting at each other over the din of the needles as she and her coworkers, you know, did their work. But one really cool story with Sarah Peacock, one tattoo that she did was on the back of this biker named Randy, and it was the traditional biker tattoo of a sprawling graveyard scene, and you saw the gravestones, but they weren't filled in yet, and he would get each one filled in basically as his biker buddies rode on off to that rally in the sky as they died. And then later on, I think it was after I saw this tattoo. Later on, I was reading about memorial quilts, colonial memorial quilts. And one motif you'd see again and again was the graveyard quilt. And this is actually an illustration in the book of a quilt made to look like a graveyard, and there are coffins around the edge of the quilt, and they're embroidered with the names of the members of the family. And then as each person died, they're moved to the center of the quilt, upon which is embroidered a graveyard. So, you know, you sort of see these same ideas sort of repeat themselves again and again in history, which I just found amazing.
We're talking with Kate Sweeney, author of American Afterlife, Encounters in the Customs of Mourning. And we want to hear from you. What customs do you and your family practice when it comes to remembering, memorializing a loved one? What questions do you have about the way we cope with death? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org.
We're talking now with Kate Sweeney. She's the author of American Afterlife, Encounters in the Customs of Mourning. And we want you to join the conversation with us as well. Does death both fascinate and scare you? And what traditions did you turn to when a loved one died? Was there a tribute that touched you, maybe in particular at a funeral? You can let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. You can also leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll go now to our callers and take Bruce joining us in Richland Center. Hi, Bruce.
Hello. Hey, I just wanted to share a little story about my grandfather's death a few years ago. He had a nice full life and died at 92. He had 9 children and countless number of grandchildren. And he died in his home surrounded by his 9 children. He was on his deathbed. I guess we used the living room as a parlor. As he was passing his final breaths, his children all sang to him as he was passing, and it was very impactful on me. It was beautiful, you know.
Yeah, that does sound beautiful.
Wow.
And like something, one of these stories that we might have heard with Kate Sweeney in the book, is that something that used to be more common, what Bruce is describing?
I think so. I mean, people certainly died a lot more often at home. You know, in earlier generations, for sure. You know, you think about things like the Civil War, in which people suddenly their loved ones were dying far away, and you know, and folks didn't know necessarily, you know, where they were or in what state they had died. And you see correspondence between fellow soldiers and family members about that, because people just really, really wanted to know. Okay, well, how did he die? And and so certainly back then, yeah, you would see ideally folks sort of having the kind of experience that Bruce described. That was really poignant. Thank you.
Bruce, thank you so much for sharing that story. We'll go to Darlene in Viola now. Darlene, hi.
Yes, hi. I have a comment regarding an experience with my mother when she died a number of years ago. I did a little bit of research to find out what is involved in embalming a body after death, and my mother always wanted a closed casket, number one. Number two, even if she didn't, I did refuse to have her body desecrated by having the internal organs removed, and to have her body preserved and to made to look plastic-like so that people would remember what she looked like in death rather than in life.
And Kate, there's a controversy among some people, at least, over embalming and over how people are presented in open caskets. I think you touch on that a little in your book.
Certainly. I mean, you have these two camps at work today. One really rising trend is the green burial movement. And when I first started following this in 2007, there were 4 green burial cemeteries in the United States. And then when I called somebody from the Green Burial Council last year to sort of follow up on this, I found out that there are 40 now. And when I'm talking about green burial, I'm talking about ecologically friendly burial. And there are dedicated green burial cemeteries across the country now. They do not allow embalming or anything that doesn't biodegrade completely down to nothing. So often, you know, wicker caskets or pine caskets or just a shroud. And they really actually also encourage families to be involved in the interment, in the burial, you know, to dig the grave or to fill in the grave and to be as involved as they wish to be. And so that's a really interesting trend to see rising today.
All right. Well, thank you for that call. And let's go next to Kate in Sussex. Hi, Kate. I'm sorry, Sue. Sorry.
Hi.
Sue, hi. Kate is our guest. Hi, Sue. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah. Actually, on that same vein, I'm widowed. My husband died at the age of 48 from cancer. And it was we both are very big into ecology, and we tried to live as green as possible. And it was so important to him. He actually has a family member, an uncle and cousins who are in the funeral industry, and he had a particular aversion toward it because of his experiences with that when he was growing up. He felt that it was just not, he thought it was really not a pleasant situation. So he chose green burial before he passed away, and we did a lot of investigating. Mm-hmm. And he was able to not be embalmed. We even had potted trees around his wooden casket that was made by the monks over in Iowa. And there were little crosses carved out of the wood that we all got to keep. And it was all able to be naturally, you know, going back to the earth. So it was very, very special that he was able to do this. It meant a lot to him.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that experience, Sue. And lots of little details there about the different ways green burials can unfold. I know for some people you have to make sure that a green burial is allowed in a particular, you know, say, cemetery. What other things do people need to know about green burial if they want to do it, Kate?
Well, I mean, I know there are certain dedicated green burial cemeteries across the country, and there's a website that the Green Burial Council, if you look them up, they can really sort of give you lots of details on the ins and outs of those. A lot of green burial cemeteries actually do allow cremated remains as well. But I think that there is a widespread misconception that if a body is not cremated, then it must be embalmed. And that's not required in any of the 50 states. And so that's a good thing for folks to sort of disabuse themselves of. Another widely held misconception is that, you know, you must have a vault around the casket. That is a regulation that a lot of cemeteries have in place, and most cemeteries indeed. And here's a sort of interesting historic fact. Vaults were invented back in the 1800s to prevent grave robbers. But as time has gone on, you know, that's not so much an issue anymore. And cemeteries use them because they prevent the ground from really sinking in around a casket after it is buried. Although a lot of funeral directors will sell vaults based on other merits, on body preservation, on, you know, this vault or that vault's ability to keep a body safe somehow from the elements, you know, from oxygen or from water. And so that's kind of an interesting thing to see, you know, it kind of makes you think about our relation to the days of the Egyptians.
We'll go back to our callers now with Rebecca in Oconto Falls. Rebecca, hi.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good. Did you have a story for us?
Yep. I actually have a story about my great-grandmother's burial. She died on her 103rd birthday. So, of course, she knew that she was going to die old, and she had said for many years that all of us better not dare give her an open casket because she didn't want people to stand there and be like, oh, she looked so good. She goes, I'm over 100. I'm not going to look good when I'm dead. It's just impossible. And then as we went through, you know, picking out caskets and stuff, and my grandmother, of course, did all this, my great-grandmother had a dress picked out that she was going to wear, and it was teal. And my grandmother picked out an aquamarine casket. So, of course, through the funeral, my sister and I are sitting there giggling because her dress actually clashed with her casket, and that would have drove her insane.
All right. Thank you so much for sharing that, Rebecca. So, Kate, are we more and more taking control over how our earthly afterlife is handled?
You know, Rob, I think so. And I think what we're seeing is this trend with the baby boomer generation. This is the generation that, you know, made so many social changes take place and also really wanted to take charge of many rites of passage in their own lives. You know, these are folks who reinvented, you know, the home home birth and things like getting married on the beach. And so, you know, looking at this last rite of passage, you know, folks really want to take charge of that as well, and death and dying, and say, you know, this is going to happen, but I'd like for it to happen on my terms.
Kay, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. This was a lot of fun.
We've been talking to Kate Sweeney, author of American Afterlife, Encounters in the Customs of Mourning. She joined us from the studios of WABE in Atlanta.
It's Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear about the new collection from one of America's most famous short story writers.
But first, the Obama administration is proposing a far-reaching overhaul of the NSA's bulk phone records program.
If passed by Congress, the plan would end systematic collection of data about Americans' calling habits, plus the NSA could only get specific records with permission from a judge.
Some privacy advocates have welcomed this reform. Past legislation, though, has been held up because of concerns about national security. Donald Downs joins us now. He's a professor of political science, law, and journalism at UW-Madison. Donald, welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. Good afternoon.
Well, there's been reluctance in the past ever since the Snowden leaks let us know that this NSA surveillance was going on. There's been reluctance from the White House, the intelligence community, Congress to tamper, saying this could interfere with national security needs.
Right. So
do you think that is a real concern?
Well, I think it's a real concern, but it still has to. We're not sure whether or not it would have that kind of effect. You know, there's dispute over whether or not the previous way that NSA was used prevented attacks. Apparently, there hasn't been a whole lot of concrete evidence on that. But if I had to really, you know, stake out a position right now, I would say that the evidence is really unclear to what extent this would be damaging, to what extent it would be helpful for civil liberties. It's not entirely clear. Again, I've been traveling today. I've just read a couple reports about the new administration's proposal. It's not entirely clear what the administration's doing here. And then when you apply that to what's going to come up out of Congress, mm-hmm. what kind of products eventually going to emerge, we're not even clear about that. So right now, I think we're sort of in a state of uncertainty.
Well, yeah, and there are details supposed to come out the next couple of days from President Obama. The basic concept and some of what's coming up before Congress is, hey, NSA, you can't have a server packed with 5 years
right.
of all Americans' phone records.
Right.
They'll be maintained at phone companies for, I think, a year and a half. You want them? Great. With, you know, with a judge's approval is at least one of the proposals out there.
Right, right.
Is that an improvement, do you think?
Well, it's a change, and it could be an improvement. Let's look at it from the more skeptical side, though. This proposal only applies to email. It doesn't apply to social media, video cameras, the internet, things like that. And if indeed the administration can get really quick access to what the phone companies have, does it really matter whether the government's holding these records or the private companies are? Also, for the most part, the government hasn't used data that's more than 18 months old anyway, even though it can hold it up to 5 years, because you know they know that the older the stuff is, the less relevant it is or the less important it is for finding people. So it's not entirely clear how big of a change this is, but there is one area that could make a big difference, and I just right now it's a black box to me. And that is getting to the content of the messages. According to what has been said under the current method, in order to look at the actual content of the phone conversations, they had to get a warrant from the FISA court. Okay, and if indeed they still have to do that, then that's going to sort of continue at least somewhat of a barrier that's been there already. So we really may not change anything. The issue, though, is that the FISA court tends to be very, very compliant to the administration's concerns. Now, one other point here, though, do they, under the new approach, will they need to get judicial approval just to get the phone numbers?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and before, they could get the phone numbers automatically. They're right there. And they apply their logarithms to that to see whether or not the phone numbers added up to some sort of, you know, suspicious set of phone calls. If they need to get the FISA court to okay getting even the phone numbers, then that is potentially a fairly significant change, depending upon how inconvenient that would be for the administration.
There's also talk of limiting the number of jumps in those phone number links. So right now, I think it's three steps. So I call our producer. Our producer calls you, Donald Downs. You call your neighbor.
Right.
They can keep tracking to that neighbor. Under
that's
the new
correct.
System, it's two jumps. It's me to our producer to you, and then no further jumps.
Yeah, and I think that's fairly significant because it would put a lot fewer people subject to having their phone numbers looked at quickly and the content looked at quickly. So that could be something that would be important. It doesn't really change the intrinsic power of what the government does it, but it limits its scope.
You mentioned a black box earlier. Before these Edward Snowden leaks, this was pretty much all a black box, wasn't it? We didn't know what was being done, how it was being done, how it was being regulated, anything.
Right. Well, really, there were two types of black boxes. The first one came right after 9/11. Because the Bush administration set up this program without even consulting the full Congress. Now, apparently, members of the intelligence committees understood this, and they kind of gave it the green light until it became public, and they said, oh, my God, we didn't know about it, but that's, Congress covering itself. So then in 2006, when the New York Times and USA Today exposed what was then the NSA program, they did get authorization, more authorization from Congress, and Congress passed a law that protected the phone companies from being sued. But then, of course, after 2006, the program got even bigger, and that's what we didn't know about the second stage. So that is sort of the second black box that Snowden then exposed.
As we've been tracking this story ever since the Edward Snowden leaks, it seems like a running theme is there are some people, privacy advocates, civil libertarians, who are very upset over the surveillance.
Right.
A lot of people vaguely unsettled, but maybe not enough to make political action happen. Now we're seeing at least some kind of change from the president. Are people upset about this enough that elements of the government are going to change how they operate?
Well, I that's a really interesting question. I'm not sure. I mean, I think the same people that were upset about it before are still upset about it. The reach that Snowden showed has probably made more people concerned about it and somewhat more upset about it. I would look at it from Obama's perspective, maybe concerned about consolidating his base, especially given, political turmoil that he's going through on various fronts right now. So you're looking for his kind of a political explanation here. That might be what he's trying to do. But I don't really get a sense that the average American is all that concerned. The government, the Fourth Amendment has never applied to phone numbers because those were considered you call through the telephone to, the phone company. You've sort of surrendered that number to another party. So you've sort of surrendered your expectation of privacy. And that kind of the government's never needed search warrants in order to see what numbers people are calling. The big difference here with the NSA program is how extensive it was, the huge mega data that they were compiling. But then again, in some ways, the more data they have, maybe functionally, de facto, there's relatively more privacy for people because there's so much of it, our individual phone calls are just buried under this avalanche of other people's phone calls. And the government couldn't look at that stuff until a court gave them the authorization to look at it. They could just look at the phone number. Now, that said, the more the government can trace what we do with our phone numbers, if indeed they're focusing on us, then they can find out a lot more about what we're doing with book, what booksellers we're communicating with, maybe a psychiatrist's office, things like that. So it's not like they couldn't get at our privacy before, but there was so much of it, we were sort of protected just by the vastness of the program.
It seems like there's this foot race going on between our 18th century document, the Bill of Rights, our 20th century legal system, and this 21st century technology.
Yeah, there's no question. And that's in the history of the Fourth Amendment, having to apply the Fourth Amendment. And a lot of this stuff isn't even Fourth Amendment stuff. It's what the federal government might prohibit by statute. So you have some privacy rights that are given us by Congress's legislation and privacy rights given us by the Fourth Amendment. They're not always the same thing. But there's always been a kind of lag effect in adjusting both statutory and constitutional rights to new technology. And unfortunately, the more pervasive a form of technology gets, the more the court has said we don't really have a reasonable expectation of privacy anymore because it's out there in the public realm so much that you just can't expect to have privacy.
Well, we've got these new proposals being unveiled by the White House, some plans, as you mentioned, in Congress. What are the chances of some kind of significant change getting through that divided Congress?
Well, that's a really good question. I think that there's going to be some sort of change. But the big question is going to be whether or not it's significant. Some sources I've looked at, or what the Obama administration's come up with today, say it really isn't all that different. It's just a little less scope, and that'll depend on whether or not there's a hurdle the government has to go through even to get the phone numbers. So that's a big unanswered question right now. But if it's made so, you know, depending on the standards that the court will require, it may not be all that much of a change. It just might be more symbolic. And that would be maybe politically advantageous to Congress, right? And Obama, yeah, we've done this thing. Aren't we good guys? But in the same token, maybe they're just going to be perpetuating what they've already got. So the devil's going to be in the details, you know.
Donald Downs, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
That's Donald Downs, professor of political science, law, and journalism at UW-Madison, talking about the president's proposal today to end the NSA's bulk collection of phone call data.
One of Wisconsin Public Radio's most prominent amassers of books, Steve Paulson, joins us now to share some of the best reads that he's come across lately. Steve is the executive producer of To the Best of Our Knowledge, and he's with us here in studio. Steve, thanks for coming by again.
Oh, it is always a pleasure.
Well, we're going to start out with Lori Moore, maybe the most celebrated short story writer of our time. She used to belong to Wisconsin entirely. She taught at the UW-Madison, but now we have to share her. She's got a new collection out. Can you tell us what she's written?
Yes, it's a collection of short stories called Bark, which is her first collection of short stories in 15 years. So this is a literary event. And as you were saying, Lori Moore was a mainstay of writing here in Wisconsin, taught for many years at the UW, and has since recently moved to Nashville, where she's now teaching, and Vanderbilt. And this is a collection of stories. Most of the stories are dealing with characters kind of in middle age. It's sort of bittersweet relationships, and it has the trademark Lori Moore style. I mean, she has a very distinctive style. Her voice is
witty.
You would recognize it anywhere. Well, it's sort of this combination of funny and awful. And I mean, that's the thing that's sort of amazing about her. And so she manages to bring humor into anxieties, into misery, and often within the same paragraph or even the same sentence. I mean, that's the thing that I think sort of jumps out at you about her writing.
And you interviewed her recently, right?
I did, yes. And
was she in studio?
She was in studio, yes.
Back in Wisconsin for a while. Well, you brought along a clip for us to listen to from that interview. Do you want to set it up for us?
Sure. So this is reading from the very beginning of the first story in the book. And it's about a guy named Ira, who is down on his luck, recently divorced, and he is reflecting on how his life has turned out. So let's listen.
Ira had been divorced 6 months and still couldn't get his wedding ring off. His finger had swelled dully around it, a combination of frustrated desire, unmitigated remorse, and misdirected ambition, he said to friends. I'm going to have my entire finger surgically removed. Maybe I should cut off the whole hand and send it to her, he said on the phone to his friend Mike, with whom he worked at the State Historical Society. You'll remove that ring when you're ready, Mike said now. Here's what you do for your depression. I'm not going to say lose yourself in charity work. I'm going to say this. Stop drinking, stop smoking, eliminate coffee, sugar, dairy products. Do this for 3 days and start everything back up again. Bam. I guarantee you, you will be so happy. I'm afraid, Ira said softly, that the only thing that would make me happy right now is snipping the brake cables on Marilyn's car.
That is a great example. Right. And I love how the friend tells him to give up smoking and dairy. Right.
So you don't know whether to laugh or to cry, right, when you hear these stories. And that is what makes Lori Moore such a great writer.
Oh, that's a fabulous one. And anything else you want to say about her, about this collection? That was one of the stories.
Yeah. Well, she even has a ghost story in this collection called Juniper Tree. But it's not really scary. And so there's this person who, this friend of the narrator of the story, who has just died but is still kind of hanging around, the dead woman is, and sort of comes back and visits and tells the narrator kind of various ways that she has fallen short in her life. And so for Lori, it's a way of, ghost stories, I think, are sort of, you can explore interesting psychological terrain there.
Did you ask her why she took so long? 15 years. That's a long time between short story collections.
Yeah, well, she did write a novel a few years ago. So, right. And she's a teacher, and
she's
so,
busy.
You know, busy life.
Yeah. Gotcha. So we're going to move along now to a different kind, a different genre. This is a writer that you say is being hailed as the modern Proust. Who's he?
In some circles, yes. He's a Norwegian writer named Karl Ove Knausgård, and he is involved in this remarkable writing project right now. See, he is he's come out with a series of books, six in all, which are basically his life story. I mean, it's memoir, except for he bills it as fiction, except for it's extremely autobiographical, and it's warts and all. He is sort of telling everything, the goriest details about his life, about his family's life, and this has been a phenomenon, not just in his native Norway, but throughout Europe. He is being hailed as sort of the hottest thing since sliced bread or whatever one has in Norway. And apparently it's so popular in Norway, some businesses have said, you know, we need Knausgård free days, because all anyone wanted to do when a new book of his came out is just to talk about these stories and to rehash them in a way. And do you want a taste of
yeah,
one?
Yeah, so, let's hear what people are so nuts about.
So he is, he sort of has this Scandinavian angst about him. And so this is a passage from his first novel. So I one thing I should say is, so the six volumes have come out in Norway and throughout Europe. They're being translated in this country, and two have been published here, and the third is about to come out. So this is a passage from the first volume. He says, "Joy is not my goal, never has been. What good is joy to me? The family is not my goal either. If it had been, and I could have devoted all my energy to it, we would have had a fantastic time, of that I am sure. We could have lived somewhere in Norway, gone skiing and skating in winter with packed lunches and a thermos flask in our backpacks, and boating in the summer, swimming, fishing, camping, holidays abroad with our families. We could have kept the house tidy, spent time making good food, being with our friends. We could have been blissfully happy. That may all sound like a caricature, but every day I see families who successfully organize their lives in this way." And then jumping ahead a bit, he goes on to say, "The question of happiness is banal, but the question that follows is not, the question of meaning. When I look at a beautiful painting, I have tears in my eyes, but not when I look at my children. That does not mean I do not love them, because I do, with all my heart. It simply means that the meaning they produce is not sufficient to fulfill a whole life. Not mine, at any rate. Soon I will be 40. And when I'm 40, it won't be long before I'm 50. And when I'm 50, it won't be long before I'm 60. And when I'm 60, it won't be long before I'm 70. And that will be that. My epitaph might read, 'Here lies a man who grinned and bore it. And in the end, he perished for it.'"
He sounds like a cheery fellow.
Yes.
And this is what's taking Norway and Europe and maybe America by storm.
It is hugely popular and very controversial, as it turns out, for a couple of reasons. One is he is spilling all the nitty-gritty details of his life, his family's life. It's a lot of these books are about his very troubled relationship with his father, who is stern, a disciplinarian, a kind of abusive, and ends up dying an alcoholic. And his father's family was furious when these came out. Apparently, they have stopped talking to him. And then the other reason why it is very controversial is he has called this book My Struggle, Min Kamp, in Norwegian, a play on Hitler's Mein Kampf.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's his struggle in his own way. And I think he was deliberately courting controversy. Now, there's nothing, you know, about nationalism or fascism or anything like that. But he is deliberately being provocative in these stories.
Now, have you made it through volumes one and two?
I have not yet. I'm still working on volume one. But it's kind of curiously addictive, because you have these long passages where he's talking about the most sort of the minutia of life. I mean, a lot of it is the teenage years. I mean, there's one whole long section where he goes on for pages and pages on how he and a buddy, when they're about 15, they're trying to figure out how to sneak a case of alcohol to a party without his father seeing it. And so you have these kind of passages, and then you have these sort of transcendent passages where he's just sort of reflecting on life. And so it's pretty remarkable.
We'll have to see if it catches on with the American psyche the way it has with the European
That's right.
and the Scandinavian. Well, before we run out of time, time, you've got a third book for us. This is in the realm of science. This one called About Time.
Right, by Adam Frank, who is an astrophysicist. And the reason I thought about this is, you know, there was that news last week of this remarkable discovery that apparently astrophysicists have sort of detected the ripples from the Big Bang 13.7 billion years ago. And Adam Frank is writing about the Big Bang. But, I mean, the thing to realize about the Big Bang is, you know, it goes back to maybe a millionth or a billionth of a second after the moment of creation. It doesn't actually go back to creation itself. And no one knows what happened back then. You know, was there just a single universe? Were there multiple universes? So there's this huge controversy about that. And Adam Frank's point is that our theories about cosmology are very much tied into our theories about time. So if you go, for instance, to the Middle Ages, that's when our notion of hours popped up. And then a little bit later, you have Isaac Newton talking about the clockwork universe, you know, as if the universe was like machine parts. And this was right at the time of the Industrial Revolution. And then skip ahead later on to the end of the 19th century. This is the time when the train has suddenly sort of totally transformed our life and our sense of time, because then suddenly what 3:05 meant in New York had to be the same as 3:05 in Philadelphia, because the trains had to...
It really takes you through the sweep of history.
Yes, exactly.
And does it in the end change the way you think about time?
It raises interesting questions. Now we're in the era of the millisecond. And, you know, we're talking about, you know, there's this race to develop the quantum computer, which would totally radically re-engineer our notions of time. So anyway, it's kind of mind-boggling.
Excellent. So lots of three great picks there. Steve, thanks so much for coming by and sharing these with us again.
No, it's always a pleasure.
We've been talking with executive producer of WPR's To the Best of Our Knowledge, also, as you see, a prodigious reader.